year, when my clever husband showed me the library.
Spain. Archivo General de Indias, Sevilla.
Few scholars had reason to poke through the bizarre range of books and objects the Gonsalves had collected over the years. Most researchers were down the street at the Archivo General de Indias, arguing about Columbus.
This repository in Seville, dating back to the end of the 16th century, is a treasure trove of valuable documents, archiving the history of Spain's colonial past and explorations in the Americas, including Christopher Columbus's journal. Madison, New York, USA. This small town in upstate New York is the home of Sarah Bishop and Emily Mather, and the place where the two women raised Diana Bishop after the death of her parents in 1983. It is one of the former agricultural and light industrial centers of 19th century America, where today hardscrabble farms and tiny villages struggle to survive as children flee to cities because the jobs have all gone elsewhere. The area was settled by New England migrants in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, and has some characteristics of New England architecture, with clapboard buildings, picket fences, and rambling, usually empty, barns. With the Bishop family dating back to the earliest settlers, it is home to one of the most powerful dynasties of witches. The Bishop House.
We turned down the rutted road leading to the Bishop House. Its late 18th century lines were boxy and generous, and it sat back from the road on a little knoll surrounded by aged apple trees and lilac bushes.
The Bishop House, located in Madison, was built by witches fleeing eastern Massachusetts and the persistent memories of Salem. The bishops moved there after the American Revolution, when the new government was encouraging settlement on the frontier. Many colonizers to upstate New York came from western Massachusetts, and they built farmhouses that looked like those they'd grown up in. The witches who constructed the house used spells as well as hammers and nails. As a result, it has the ability to grow and shrink to accommodate the family and its houseguests. It has hidden storage chambers and removes items only to return them when needed. Sometimes the house's idea of need does not correspond with that of the owner of the missing objects. Be those items socks, lost grimoires, turkey platters, craft projects, Halloween decorations, bottles of wine, or errant pieces of mail. The house is also inhabited by the Bishop ghosts, who migrated from Salem to Madison with the family in 1790.
The inspiration for the Bishop House was actually a house one of my grandfathers built in western Massachusetts in the 18th century. It's still standing, a big white house on Harkness Road in Pelham called the Harkness House. A similar house, inside and out, is on Shutesbury Road in Pelham, Massachusetts. I also spent a few happy years in upstate New York when I was teaching at Colgate University in Hamilton, and the Bishop House is partly modeled on my house there, too. It didn't grow rooms, but it did creak and sigh.
Forest of Madison and the ancient stag-headed oak.
Above me, the branches of the tree were cracked and withered. Bare limbs forked and forked again into shapes reminiscent of a stag's horns.
Diana and Matthew were forced to confront the unhinged Juliette Durand in the shadowed forest surrounding the Bishop House, at the end of a discovery of witches. As Matthew lay dying after his confrontation with Juliette, Diana made a deal with the goddess and used the life force of an old oak to save the man she loved. London, England. Like Oxford, London is steeped in memory and magic, and the juxtaposition of ancient and modern is ever-present in this setting. Diana and Matthew have shared two Londons. The first, the Elizabethan Square Mile, within and just outside the early Roman walls, known as the City. The second, the more expansive modern metropolis. This multi-layered combination of worlds is embodied in areas such as the Barbican, the medieval church of St. Giles Cripplegate, near the crumbling Roman wall of the old city, is set within the present-day arts precinct. It is a world within a world, at once Roman, medieval, and current, the ancient and magical hiding in plain sight, nestled within a modern frame. Creatures of every group are woven into the fabric of the city and have organized themselves into alliances, often according to their location. The witches' gatherings and reeds span the city in connection with the delineation of different parishes, while vampires within the square mile of the city answer to the vampire king of London, Andrew Hubbard, as do the demons and witches Cod and his family. The City of Elizabethan London.
It looks like a demented hedgehog, I observed. The London skyline was filled with needle-like spires that stuck up from the huddle of buildings that surrounded them.
London in 1590 was limited to the square mile of the city proper and its near surrounding suburbs. Covent Garden was open fields, and there was nothing but houses between the Inns of Court and Westminster. Remnants of the Roman walls still surrounded it. That said, the square mile is far less crowded now than it would have been in the Elizabethan period, when Matthew introduced Diana to the London he knew. By 1600, it's estimated that nearly 200,000 people lived in that square mile, which included people of many nationalities speaking dozens of different languages. There were even foreign language schools and churches in the city, so it was very cosmopolitan. Its boundaries today are roughly the same, marked by the red and white standards signifying where the city ends and the rest of London begins.
One of the things I've enjoyed most about writing the All Souls trilogy was the chance to bring late 16th century London, the London I spent more than 15 years researching as a scholar, to life for my readers. I know a lot about the city during the reign of Elizabeth. Not everything, but a lot. Some of it made its way into my history books and articles, but not all of it. My challenge in Shadow of Night was to paint a portrait of the city that was as round and real and three-dimensional as possible. It was all the more important to me because the Elizabethan city is barely perceptible in modern London. Much of what Diana and Matthew would have known was destroyed by fire in 1666 or by bombs in World War II. I did what I could to reconstruct it with words and hoped readers' imaginations would fill in the rest.
Blackfriars.
When Matthew turned us toward the city, I looked up. There was St. Paul's. I'm not likely to get lost with that in the neighborhood, I murmured. As we made our slow progress toward the cathedral, my senses grew accustomed to the chaos, and it was possible to pick out individual sounds, smells, and sights. Bread baking, coal fires, wood smoke, fermentation, freshly washed garbage courtesy of yesterday's rains, wet wool.
Diana and Matthew lived in a neighborhood called Blackfriars. It takes its name from the Dominican friars who set up their priory in the area between the Thames and Ludgate Hill in 1276. Very little remains of the once ecclesiastical complex that stood south of Ludgate, but tucked into the maze of narrow medieval streets near St. Paul's, you can find some traces of the graveyard and the churchyard. St. Paul's Cathedral.
What is that? I gasped, pointing to a vast expanse of stone pierced by tall windows. High above the wooden roof was a charred, stout stump that made the building's proportions look all wrong. St. Paul's, Matthew explained. This was not Christopher Wren's graceful white-domed masterpiece, its bulk concealed until the last moment by modern office blocks. Old St. Paul's, perched on London's highest hill, was seen all at once. Lightning struck the spire, and the wood of the roof caught fire. The English believe it was a miracle the entire cathedral didn't burn to the ground.
Wren's domed masterpiece marks the spot atop Ludgate Hill, where once a great medieval cathedral stood. The old St. Paul's that Diana saw was in fact the fourth incarnation of the cathedral, which was started by the Normans in the 11th century. Following the English Reformation in the early 16th century, the building became run down, and many sites in the churchyard were sold off to printers and booksellers who had already congregated in this area of London. This also meant that St. Paul's Churchyard was a vibrant center of learning in the city, where pamphlets and books were circulated, the latest news and gossip exchanged, and rigorous sermons from Protestant preachers heard. When the spire was struck by lightning in 1561, leaving a blackened stump, the Protestants and Catholics blamed each other for incurring God's anger. The medieval structure was finally destroyed in the Great Fire of 1666 and rebuilt by Christopher Wren to become the iconic building that survives today. The bookshops that surrounded the cathedral are long gone, but if you look down while you walk in the precincts, you might be able to find the stone that marks the spot where Diana heard a sermon preached at St. Paul's Cross. The Heart and Crown.
The building was half-timbered like most on the street. A vaulted passage spanned two arrays of windows. The passage emptied out into the building's interior courtyard, a luxury in a city as densely packed as London. The courtyard boasted another rare amenity, a well that provided clean water to the residents of the complex. Someone had taken advantage of the courtyard's southern exposure by tearing up the old paving stones to plant a garden, and now its neat, empty beds patiently awaited spring.
The Heart and Crown, the residence in which Diana and Matthew had rooms in Tudor London, was on Water Lane in Blackfriars. In a city as cramped as London was at the time, they were lucky to have the spacious apartment they did, including the hidden archive room that Matthew revealed to Diana, decorated with strange hanging files filled with de Clermont family secrets. Water Lane would have been a bustling, narrow street, with creaking signs on each dwelling denoting the services for sale in the wide array of shops. The Hawleys, a shoemaker and his wife, with whom Diana and Matthew shared the building, appear in the historical records of the period, living and working in Blackfriars, and the building's complex was a community within a community. With so little remaining of the old Elizabethan city today, Water Lane has long since been renamed and built over. To imagine what the Heart and Crown might have been like, you can look at Staple Inn, situated in Holborn, northwest of Blackfriars, built in 1585. This is one of the few remaining Tudor buildings that has survived fire and war, and has the same timber-framed facade and inner courtyard that the Heart and Crown would have had. Belle Savage Inn.
Matthew treated me to dinner at the famous Belle Savage Inn just outside the Blackfriars on Ludgate Hill. More than a simple eatery, the Belle Savage was an entertainment complex where customers could see plays and fencing matches, not to mention Morocco, the famous horse who could pluck virgins out of the crowd.
Records show that the Belle Savage Inn existed as far back as the beginning of the 15th century, and by 1590, it had developed into the entertainment complex that Diana visited with Matthew. Morocco, also known as Banks's Horse after his trainer, William Banks, was a popular London attraction for the Elizabethan audiences. Born around 1586, the famous horse worked the London inns and traveled throughout the country, even into Scotland, until his death around 1606. Morocco was known for being able to walk on two legs and play dead, and he was sometimes called the politic horse because he would bow when the queen's name was mentioned and bare his teeth and chase his master off stage if the name of the Spanish king, Philip II, was uttered. And yes, one of his most applauded acts was picking out the virgins in the crowd of onlookers. Playhouse Yard.
It took me only a few steps to reach a narrow, cobbled street that used to lead to the inner precincts of the old Blackfriars Priory. I frowned and pointed. Wasn't the cardinal's hat in there? It was one of Kit Marlowe's watering holes.
Good memory, Auntie. They call it Playhouse Yard now.
Our house had backed up to that part of the former monastery.
A plaque on the wall explains that the small, paved area in the heart of the city might have been the site of one of London's first public playhouses. It is here, and in the surrounding streets, where Diana remembered her Elizabethan experiences in the city, conjuring the long-lost Tudor houses and doorways as she met up with a member of the contemporary London witches' gathering. Baynard's Castle.
Matthew nodded and directed my attention down the street. And that is Baynard's Castle. It was the largest building I had seen yet, except for the tower, St. Paul's, and the distant prospect of Westminster Abbey. Three crenellated towers faced the river, linked by walls that were easily twice the height of any nearby houses.
Like so much of the Elizabethan city, Baynard's castle is now nothing more than a sign on the corner of a busy intersection near the Blackfriars Underground Station. It is worth seeing, if only to realize that once upon a time this was riverfront property. Taking its name from the original castle built by Ralph Baynard, who came to England with William the Conqueror, it was rebuilt by Henry VII in 1428. Henry VIII gave it to Catherine of Aragon, and on Henry's death it passed to the Pembroke family, who used it as their lavish London residence. Diana passed many happy hours with Mary Sidney at the castle, where one of the tower rooms had been converted into Mary's personal alchemical laboratory. Sadly, the castle was destroyed in the Great Fire of 1666, with the remaining ruins finally disappearing in the 19th century. Christ Church Greyfriars.
We gather once a month in Father Hubbard's crypt. He lives in what's left of the Greyfriars Priory, just over there.
Andrew Hubbard's modern-day London house is located not far from St. Paul's Cathedral, in what was once the Greyfriars Monastery Church. Henry VIII first dissolved the medieval monastery. Its accompanying church was renamed Christ Church, and was later destroyed in the Great Fire. Christopher Wren's smaller replacement was subsequently hit by bombs in World War II. A peaceful rose garden has been planted in the ruins of the main body of the church, from where you can view the tower that remains. The tower has been converted into a private residence, and it was the inspiration for Hubbard's house. The three ghosts at Greyfriars, whom Diana and Linda Crosby discussed in The Book of Life, refer to three women buried there. Queen Isabella, the she-wolf of France, was wife to Edward II. Historians dispute whether she and her lover merely deposed or also murdered the king. On her death in 1358, she was buried in Greyfriars, dressed in her wedding mantle. Centuries later, the reputedly beautiful Agnes Hungerford, found guilty of murdering her husband and hanged at Tyburn in 1523, was buried too at Greyfriars. Stories from the 19th century report sightings of these two ghostly women in the church grounds, fighting furiously. The third ghost Diana saw, the hysterical Elizabeth Barton, was the Mad Maid of Kent, who was also buried at Greyfriars in the 16th century. Often succumbing to fits and visions, Elizabeth landed herself in trouble when she prophesied against Henry VIII's marriage to Anne Boleyn, and she was executed at Tyburn in 1534. Her later prophecy that Diana would have twins proved accurate. The Inns of Court.
I heard he was at the Middle Temple Hall with Christopher Marlowe last night, watching a play by all accounts.
Matthew Royden and Kit Marlowe used to gamble and drown their sorrows at the Inns of Court. Dating back to the medieval period, these four inns, Gray's Inn, Inner Temple, Lincoln's Inn, and Middle Temple, then and now were training grounds for lawyers and also served as gentlemanly finishing schools for the elite. Middle Temple Hall is one of the few buildings from Matthew Royden's time to have survived the ravages of fire and World War. The nearby Temple Church, now belonging to Inner and Middle Temple Halls, also still stands, although it is heavily restored. Built by the Knights Templar in the late 12th century, it operated as part of their English treasury and headquarters, and many of the order's secret initiation ceremonies took place there. The Parish of St. James Garlickhithe.
The area surrounding St. James Church was far more prosperous than the Blackfriars, with spacious, well-kept streets, large houses, busy shops, and a tidy churchyard.
The Parish of St. James Garlickhithe, where Susanna Norman, Goody Alsop, and the rest of the Garlickhithe gathering lived, was a prosperous area in the Elizabethan city of London. The old medieval church of St. James, like most in this area, was destroyed in the Great Fire, but the replacement rebuilt by Wren still stands. The name Garlickhithe was taken from the nearby landing spot in the Thames, where ships carrying garlic bulbs from France had docked and traded since the Middle Ages. The French ships also carried wine, and the parish has had a long association with it, placed within the Vintry Ward, of which Goody Alsop was an elder, one of the 25 wards of the City of London. It also has some of the oldest parish records in the country, going back to 1535. Hugh Platt, who tipped off George Chapman about a mysterious manuscript in John Dee's possession, lived in the area. And Susanna Norman is recorded as the parish midwife. The Royal Exchange.
The Royal Exchange. I turned to him in excitement. At night! You remembered! We entered through the wide arches next to the bell tower topped with a golden grasshopper. Inside, I turned around slowly to get the full experience of the four-storied building with its 100 shops selling everything from suits of armor to shoehorns. Statues of English monarchs looked down on the customers and merchants, and a further plague of grasshoppers ornamented the peak of each dormer window.
Diana got her wish and was able to see the original Tudor Royal Exchange at night, atmospherically lit with lanterns and dancers enjoying the music put on by merchants for the customers. The Royal Exchange was founded by the influential and wealthy merchant Sir Thomas Gresham in the 1560s. It was officially opened in 1571 by Elizabeth I to be used as a center of commerce and trade, the first of its kind in the city. The ornamental grasshoppers Diana noticed on the building were from the Gresham family crest, and the weather vane of the Royal Exchange today, which is the third incarnation, the previous two buildings having been destroyed by fire, is still a golden grasshopper in honor of its founder. The Barbican.
The closer we got to the apothecary's place of business, the colder the air felt. Just as at St. Paul's, there was another surge of power, but an oppressive atmosphere of poverty and desperation hung over the neighborhood. An ancient tower crumbled on the northern side of the street, and the houses around it looked as though a gust of wind might carry them away. Two youths shuffled closer, eyeing us with interest, until a low hiss from Pierre stopped them in their tracks.
Diana visited John Chandler, the apothecary living to the north of the city walls, in an area known then and now as the Barbican, in honor of the Roman gateway that once stood there. It was the site of a Jewish community in the 12th century, including their burial ground, as Matthew explained to Diana. By the Elizabethan era, it was an insalubrious neighborhood, home to thieves, prostitutes, and outcasts. But writers and actors also lived there, perhaps drawn by the relatively low rent. Today, the Barbican is a modern residential and arts complex, with echoes of its past in street names such as Jewin Street, as well as ruins of the city's ancient Roman walls still visible alongside the medieval Church of St. Giles Cripplegate. If you want an even better sense of London's history, the Museum of London is also nearby. Bedlam.
Bedlam was an oubliette in all but name. A place for forgetting, where the insane were locked up with those interred by their own families on some trumped-up charge, simply to be rid of them. With nothing but straw for bedding, no regular supply of food, not a shred of kindness from the jailers, and no treatment of any sort. Most inmates never escaped. If they did, they rarely recovered from the experience.
Bedlam, or Bethlehem, was founded in 1247 as a hospital for the poor by the Order of St. Mary of Bethlehem. By the 15th century, it had gradually come to house the insane. Still functioning as such more than 600 years later, it is Europe's oldest surviving psychiatric hospital. When Diana visited in 1591, she was admitted by the master in charge of the institution at the time, Master Slefford, and the hospital was still on its original site, located just outside the city walls near Bishopsgate. Diana saw for herself the appalling conditions of the place, so notorious that the name Bedlam entered the English language as a word meaning uproar and confusion. By the 1660s, the buildings were so decayed that they were demolished, and a new hospital was built in 1675-76, just north of London Wall in Moorfields. It has continued to move farther out of the city over the centuries, and Bethlam Royal Hospital is now in the suburbs of southeast London. Recent archaeological work carried out at Liverpool Street Station has uncovered a 16th-century mass grave thought to contain the remains of former Bedlam inmates, giving still more evidence of the place's dark history. It is an institution that has had a particular impact on the lives of demons in London and England. The Thames and the Frost Fairs.
Matthew shared his memories of the city during the course of the afternoon as the tide rose and fell. He told me about the time in the 15th century when the Thames froze for more than 3 months, so long that temporary shops were built on the ice to cater to the foot traffic.
Though the River Thames in London is a tidal estuary, it does sometimes freeze over. During the early modern period, Europe experienced widespread climate change. Known at times as the Little Ice Age, this drop in temperatures led to a decrease in arable land and poor harvest. But challenges like these could sometimes provide opportunity. When the river froze, it drove London's busy watermen out of business, as they could not ply their oars or their trade, shuttling passengers from the playhouses of Southwark to the city. Instead, people walked across the ice, and in a city that was full of trade regulations, this new expanse of frozen river enabled the establishment of a free market zone of shops, dramatic entertainments, temporary pubs and eating establishments, you name it. These moments of hard freeze were called frost fairs, and sometimes artists preserved them on canvas, as in the freeze of 1683 to 84. The incident Matthew referred to was in 1410, when the Thames froze for 14 weeks. Greenwich Palace.
The fourth floor tower room in Greenwich Palace afforded a sweeping view of the grey river, muddy ground, and England's stormy skies. In spite of the many windows, the silvery morning light did little to dispel the heaviness of the room, which was resolutely masculine and early Tudor in its furnishings. The carved initials on the ceiling, an intertwined H and A for Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, indicated that the room had been decorated around the time of Elizabeth's birth and seldom used since.
The Grand Tudor Greenwich Palace, or the Palace of Placentia, as it was called, became one of the principal royal residences when Henry VII took power, replacing a medieval royal manor. In Henry VIII's reign, Greenwich was a particular favorite, witnessing many of the highs and lows of his rule. Lavish banquets and Christmas celebrations, including one of the first masquerades in the kingdom, and nightly tournaments in the tilt yard. Henry VIII was injured and almost died during one of the jousts. In the same tilt yard, Diana had her near-fatal encounter with Louisa de Clermont and Kit Marlowe. Henry's daughter Elizabeth was born at Greenwich. Later it was where her mother, Anne Boleyn, was arrested for adultery, and from where she was taken by barge downriver to the Tower of London. The palace was demolished in the 17th century, and there is a marker on the site, where the Greenwich Old Royal Naval College now stands. John Dee's Library, Mortlake.
Dee owned more books than any of the Oxford or Cambridge colleges, and he required a working library, not one for show. Not surprisingly, the most precious commodity was not light or seating, but shelf space. To maximize what was available, Dee's bookshelves were freestanding and set perpendicular to the walls. The simple oak bookshelves were double-faced, with the shelves set at varied heights to hold the different sizes of Elizabethan books. Two sloped reading surfaces topped the shelves, making it possible to study a text and then accurately return it.
John Dee's house in Mortlake, where Diana and Matthew viewed his enormous collection, has long since been destroyed. The modern flats now standing there are appropriately called John Dee House. The All Souls' descriptions of his library, which 16th century scholars from all over Europe visited, were based on the old library at Trinity Hall, Cambridge. As Diana observed, Dee's library would not have looked like those we are familiar with today, but would have been built for practicality of storage and study. According to Dee, he possessed nearly 3,000 books and 1,000 manuscripts on a huge variety of subjects, from alchemy to mathematics and astronomy, including the treasured book he called Roger Bacon's Verum Secretum Secretorum, which Diana knew was really the Book of Life. When the Dees went traveling in Europe in the 1580s, Dee entrusted his brother-in-law as caretaker for his precious library. Sadly, Dee came home to a decimated collection, with a huge number of books sold off, stolen, and lost to him forever. Scholars have since located many of the volumes that once belonged to Dee, now scattered in various collections and identifiable by his distinctive annotations and doodles in the margins, including the Dee pointing finger. The Royal College of Physicians in London holds the largest collection of his annotated books. It is through these notes and illustrations that we are given a glimpse into the mind of this enigmatic scholar. Richmond Palace.
My first glimpse of Richmond Palace was the top of a creamy stone tower, the royal standard snapping in the breeze. More towers soon appeared, sparkling in the crisp winter air like those of a castle out of a fairy story.
Only a few traces remain of this once famous palace, built in 1501 by Henry VII, on the banks of the Thames to the west of the city of London. It was another of Elizabeth I's principal residences, where she enjoyed having plays performed for her, and where she died in 1603. The palace was eventually sold off and slowly dismantled following the English Civil War in the mid-17th century. Elements of the original structure remain in buildings still visible today, such as the gatehouse, the wardrobe, and Trumpeter's House, which takes its name from two statues of trumpeters believed to have originally adorned the old palace's middle gate. Mayfair. Mayfair, St. James, and the Mall. In Elizabethan times, these areas of London were nothing more than fields and a few houses. Now they contain some of the priciest real estate, the finest hotels, and the most luxurious boutiques in London. As the city outgrew its walls and spread toward Westminster in the 17th and 18th centuries, these areas became prized residential enclaves. It's not surprising that the de Clermont family put down roots here. Clermont House.
This cannot be my house, Leonard. The palatial brick mansion's expansive five-windowed frontage and towering four stories in one of London's toniest neighborhoods made it inconceivable. I felt a pang of regret, though. The tall windows were trimmed in white to stand out against the warm brick, their old glass winking in the midday sunshine.
Matthew Clermont's suitably luxurious house in modern-day Mayfair is a grand Georgian building that has remained unchanged since it was built. It is filled with museum pieces that Phoebe Taylor can scarcely believe are still in use. The bright entrance hall with its curved staircase leading the eye up to the domed skylight was built to impress, and when Isabeau opened the door to the forest room, Diana gasped as she took it all in. The inspiration for Matthew's Mayfair home is now the exclusive private gambling club, the Clermont Club, and only members can gain access to the interior. It was built in the mid-18th century by the architect William Kent for Lady Isabella Finch, later purchased by Lord Clermont, the Irish peer William Fortescue, 1st Earl of Clermont, on her death, and much praised at the time for its stunning interiors, including the staircase. Sotheby's.
Phoebe found the quiet at Sotheby's Bond Street offices unsettling this Tuesday night.
The prestigious auction house where Phoebe Taylor first encountered Marcus Whitmore has been one of the world's premier sources for fine and decorative arts, rare books, and manuscripts since 1744. The Sotheby's Institute of Art is known for its programs in art education and connoisseurship. Isabeau de Clermont has a special relationship with the president of Sotheby's. The Wolseley.
A slice of Battenberg cake with a moist pink and yellow checkerboard interior and canary-colored icing sat before me at our secluded table at the Wolseley, along with still more contraband black tea.
Hamish Osborne's favorite breakfast spot in London, built as a grand car showroom in the 1920s, is a wonderful place to visit at any time of day for a bite to eat and a drink. The sumptuous afternoon tea is a particular English treat. Allen's of Mayfair.
Diana's neighbors are wealthy and paranoid. There hasn't been any activity at the house for nearly a year. Suddenly, there are people around at all hours, and Allen's of Mayfair is making daily deliveries.
Located just a few blocks from the Clermont Club, Allen's of Mayfair was a well-known traditional butcher, one of the oldest in London, dating back to the mid-19th century. Sadly, since the publication of the trilogy, the shop has closed and now trades online only. Everything is of the highest quality, perfect for vampire palates. The Connaught. From the old Allens of Mayfair shop, you'll be able to see the Connaught. The house Matthew gave Diana is near this hotel, and Diana figured out that Matthew and the chef had agreed on a trade of fine wine for food fit for humans. In reality, the Connaught's wine cellar is excellent. They need no help from Matthew. If you are looking for a splurge, order a pot of tea or enjoy a glass of red wine by the fire in the hotel's Coburg Bar. Pickering Place.
Pickering Place? Unable to stop myself, I traced the letters of Matthew's signature with my finger. Marcus's house, over by St. James's Palace. It was a gift from Matthew, I understand. He lived there before he built Claremont House, Phoebe said.
Marcus's present-day London house is tucked away from the main thoroughfare of St. James's Street. For a bit of time walking, you just need to duck your head and step into the timbered alley, through to Pickering Place, where the secluded courtyard, once notorious for gambling dens, looks as it did in the 18th century. Standing in the quiet courtyard by the Armillary Sphere, you can decide which of the 18th century townhouses belongs to Marcus. Berry Brothers and Rudd. Just a few yards from Pickering Place is the wine store where Matthew and Hamish shop. The store was established in 1698 by Widow Bourne, whose son-in-law, James Pickering, built Pickering Court, as it was known then. It is still operating from the same shop hundreds of years later. Berry Brothers and Rudd has a small selection of wine on display and enormous cellars where they store the bulk of their wares, with something for every level of bank account. A sloping wooden floor tells the tale of how barrels were rolled into the shop in days gone by. The Royal Society.
I looked up from my manuscript. The Royal Society's reading room was flooded with summer sunshine. It raked through the tall, multi-paned windows and spilled across the generous reading surfaces.
Across Pall Mall at Carlton House Terrace is the sixth home of the Royal Society, where Diana attempts to go back to some normality with her research at the end of the Book of Life. Matthew would have had scientific conversations at all the previous locations, and he knew many of its most famous members, such as Isaac Newton. The organization, which was officially founded after receiving a royal charter in 1662, was given the name the Royal Society for Improving Natural Knowledge, and adopted the motto, Nilius in Verba, understood as, take nobody's word for it. The Royal Society puts on excellent exhibitions on all aspects of scientific inquiry that are open to the public. Prague, Czechoslovakia. The Prague to which Matthew and Diana traveled in the 16th century was a city teeming with talented artists and scholars from all over Europe who were drawn to the court of Rudolf II in Prague Castle. The eccentric Holy Roman Emperor Rudolf II greatly enriched Prague during his reign by patronizing the arts and scholarship, however politically inept he might have been. Rudolf's love of the occult also made the city an otherworldly oasis for all creatures of the time, witches and demons in particular. The congregation fed Rudolf whatever he wanted, be it works of art or women, to keep him on their side. Considering Rudolf's wide range of intellectual interests and his dedicated pursuit of the Philosopher's Stone, it is not surprising that Diana and Matthew's search for the Book of Life led them to his court and famed cabinet of curiosities. As Jack Blackfriars pointed out to Diana, in this period Prague was formally made up of four independent towns that were eventually united in the 18th century to form the city. Staré Město, Old Town, Hradčany, the castle district, Nové Město, New Town, and Malostrana, Little Quarter, where Diana and Matthew's house was situated. Many of the historic streets and buildings they would have passed in this district can still be seen today. Three Ravens on Sporengas, Malostrana District.
After we'd lived out of saddlebags and a single shared trunk for weeks, our belongings had arrived 3 days after we did at the tall, narrow house perched on a steep avenue leading to Prague Castle, known as Sporengasse. Our German neighbors presumably dubbed it Spur Street because that was the only way you could persuade a horse to make the climb.
This house in Prague in the Malastrana district, on a steep street leading to the castle, was the inspiration for Diana and Matthew's home. From the mid-11th century, the inhabitants of the neighborhood had been predominantly German craftsmen and merchants, as well as Italians, like the women Diana met in the market. The name for their house derived from the symbol of three ravens above the door. Following a huge fire in 1541, much of the district was destroyed and rebuilt. And residents put different symbols on the houses to distinguish them. If you walk down what the German inhabitants once called Sporengasse, now renamed Neredova Street, you can still see the red lion, the golden star, the white swan, and the two suns above the entrances to the old houses, just as Diana did as she rode uphill toward the castle to meet Rudolph.
I was climbing the hill to Prague Castle when I looked across the street and said, "That's where Diana and Matthew lived in 1591. I then stood and looked and took pictures for about 20 minutes. The house is probably a bit too recent to satisfy an architectural historian. It might not have been built until around 1605, and no doubt the facade has been restored. But this is what I think of when I imagine their house in Prague."
The Donkey and Cradle.
The Donkey and Cradle meets our needs at present, Master Royden. Mistress Kelly issued forth an awe-inspiring sneeze and took a swig of wine. We had thought the Emperor would set aside a house for us in the palace itself, given Edward's work, but this will do.
What was once the Kellys' home in Prague, and where Diana and Matthew visited them, still stands today, with the tower and its spiral staircase dating from the 16th century. It now exists as the Museum of Alchemists and Magicians, for tourists to experience the mysteries of 16th century alchemy. The Jewish Town.
Then we crossed over a wide street and passed through a gate into the Jewish town. More than 5,000 Jews lived in this small enclave, smashed between the industrial riverbank, the old town's main square, and a convent.
At the time Diana and Matthew visited Rabbi Lowe in the Jewish town, also known as Josefov and the Jewish ghetto, it was an incredibly compact, crowded area of Prague. The meandering route they were forced to take through the streets gave Diana a peek into the cramped conditions in which the city's Jews lived. The roads, at least, were paved, thanks to the generosity of Mordecai Maisel, the prosperous Jewish merchant connected to Rudolph's court, who escorted Diana back from her visit there. The period of Rabbi Lowe, and later into the 17th century, was generally known as a time of growth and safety for the Jews in Prague. In the rest of Europe, rulers and their populace were dangerously prone to persecute the minorities in their midst. Even in Prague, Jews were still required to wear a yellow marker, a ring, stitched into their clothes, which Rabbi Lowe observed Diana was better than the yellow hats they'd been required to wear previously. The grave of Rabbi Lowe can still be seen in the Jewish cemetery, and became a focus of devotion for many following his death. Prague Castle and Hradčany District.
The castle was even larger and more sprawling at close range than it had appeared at a distance, like an entirely separate city full of trade and industry. Ahead were the Gothic pinnacles of St. Vitus Cathedral, with round towers punctuating the walls. Though built for defense, the towers now housed workshops for the hundreds of artisans who made their home at Rudolph's court.
The extensive site of Prague Castle dates to the end of the 9th century, with successive rulers rebuilding and adding on to the massive castle complex through the centuries. After the fire in 1541 that destroyed much of Malastrana, the castle too suffered damage, and new Renaissance buildings were added. As the official home of the Czech Republic's president, it remains the seat of power today, and is surrounded by the Hradčany district, made up of many old aristocratic palaces. The castle was Rudolph's main residence during his reign, and was the cultural center not only of Prague, but of his whole empire. When Diana and Matthew first entered the place, Diana was in wonder at the activities going on in the various rooms they passed, with voices in German, Spanish, Latin, or Czech, engaged in heated discussions. Rudolph, as Matthew said, preferred not to live in the drafty old palace, and constructed the new northern wing, including the Spanish Hall. When the Emperor took Matthew and Diana through his extensive storerooms and cabinet of curiosities, Diana could see the building works for his improvements and additions through a window. Most important, the new rooms designed to display Rudolph's treasured art collection. Gallo Glass also acted as tour guide for Diana, showing her the delights of the castle and its precincts. One place they were not allowed, however, was the Powder Tower, where Edward Kelly worked over his crucibles and alembics. The tower survives, and you can stand outside and look up, as Diana and Gallo Glass did, imagining what alchemical secrets the demon was uncovering. The great Vladislav Hall, where Diana and Matthew staged their entertainment for Rudolph, was built at the end of the 15th century, during the reign of Vladislav II. The huge and impressive room with its high ceiling made up of a complex stone vaulting system was used for banquets and other important royal celebrations. This included, on occasion, tournaments. For this purpose, the knight's staircase leading into the room was built wide enough to accommodate horses, and Matthew himself once rode up them for a joust. Amsterdam, the Netherlands.
Matthew's house in Amsterdam turned out to be a 17th-century mansion on the most beautiful stretch of the Herengracht. He had, Matthew explained, bought it right after he left Scotland in 1605.
The Herengracht Canal, with its unique light and beautiful architecture, was where the most prosperous citizens of Amsterdam built their houses, and therefore a fitting location for a de Clermont residence. Matthew bought his house there at a time when trade was flourishing and the city was coming into the height of its prosperity. New Haven, Connecticut, USA. New Haven and its prestigious Yale University, where Diana is a professor of history, is a key place in her life. Here she was able to use the resources of the world-famous Beinecke Library to continue her search for the missing Ashmole pages, while Matthew and Miriam worked with Chris in his lab to unlock the genetic mystery of Matthew's blood rage. Surprises from Diana's and Matthew's past also turned up here, with revelations about just how closely the de Clermonts have been involved in Diana's life, even before she met Matthew. Court Street House.
Living in New Haven with Matthew was going to require some adjustment. My little row house on the tree-lined, pedestrians-only stretch of Court Street was far more Spartan than any of the residences we'd occupied over the last year, whether in the present or the past.
Diana's less luxurious but still beautiful house is one of these late 19th-century Court Street row houses. Jack Blackfriars turned up at the end of this pedestrians-only New Haven street, now a young man and a vampire who'd been waiting centuries for his reunion with Diana and Matthew. Gallo Glass's condo.
When did you buy your condo on Worcester Square, Gallo Glass? I asked, finally getting around to one of many questions about the de Clermonts and their relationship to New Haven. After you came here as a teacher, Gallo Glass said.
Gallo Glass has been watching over Diana since she was a child and is tightly bound to every important location in her life. The converted church he bought in New Haven so he could observe her comings and goings as a faculty member would look something like a former church, now living space, on Green Street. Yale.
Afterward, we strolled the paths of the residential colleges while the carillon played in Harkness Tower. College and town were just beginning to swell with returning students, who shouted greetings across the quad and shared complaints about reading lists and class schedules.
As Diana and Matthew walked through the grounds of Yale, Diana was happy to be back in her old haunts. Harkness Tower is typical of the collegiate Gothic-style buildings that make up the Yale campus. Though there is no direct connection to Deborah Harkness, there may be a distant one. The name speaks for itself. Beinecke Library.
He looked over his shoulder at the Beinecke. I know the library is an architectural treasure, but I still think it looks like an ice cube tray.
Yale's library, so different architecturally from the rest of the university, played a vital role in Diana's search for the Book of Life. It is here that she was able to study the mysterious copy of the Voynich manuscript, or Beinecke MS-408, and piece together clues about where the other two missing pages of Ashmole 782 could possibly be. As with so many things in the All Souls world, modern style and design are combined with ancient scholarship in the Beinecke building. New Orleans, Louisiana, USA. New Orleans is the vibrant and disreputable playground of Marcus Whitmore. This city, steeped in history and mysticism, was an appropriate backdrop for him to raise hell with his mad brood of children after the Louisiana Purchase at the beginning of the 19th century. The city's free spirit and dark Gothic edge is a place for all creatures to let loose. Yet even in New Orleans, the excesses of Marcus's children could not go unnoticed. The witches of the city wanted him gone, but it wasn't until Matthew arrived with Juliette Durand that their antics were halted. The place does not hold good memories for Matthew. There he was forced to cull the dangerous family that Marcus had unknowingly infected with blood rage, and there he had to seek forgiveness from those who had survived. To this day, the sensory experiences of New Orleans, of food, jazz, and bourbon, are irresistible to all creatures with a taste for self-indulgence and hedonism. The Domino Club, Royal Street.
The Domino Club on Royal Street hadn't changed much since Matthew had first walked through its doors almost two centuries ago. The three-story facade, gray walls, and crisp black-and-white painted trim was the same. The height of the arched windows at street level.
The Domino Club on Royal Street has been run by Marcus's surviving son, Ransom Fairweather, as a private gentleman's club since it first opened in 1839. A considerable number of its patrons signed up then, with its other private members carefully chosen for their ability to lose large sums of money at the gambling tables. LaLaurie Mansion, which the Domino Club was inspired by, is located on Royal Street in New Orleans. It dates back to the 1830s and has its own grisly history worthy of the darkest vampire stories in the city. The first owner, Delphine LaLaurie, became notorious at the time for cruelty to her slaves. When a fire broke out at the house, many of them were discovered locked in a room, victims of brutal torture and murder. A mob subsequently rampaged the house, but Delphine escaped with her husband and children. No one was brought to justice for the crimes. Matthew's difficult meeting with Ransom at the Domino Club ultimately mended the feud between them, and Ransom agreed to join the new Bishop Claremont Scion. Venice, Italy. Venice is a constant presence in the background of A Discovery of Witches and Shadow of Night, and it finally comes to the fore with Diana's visit to the congregation at the end of the trilogy. The city's canals, vaporettos, lagoon, and architecture, steeped in ancient history and ruthless politics, constitute an important setting for the congregation and vampire history. Venice is also a vital hub for modern demon and witch culture, with its lively art scene, fashion, film industry, and tourism. During events such as Carnival in February and the Witches' Regatta, Regatta del Befan, the creature subcultures rise up and take center stage. Diana's first visit there coincided with the regatta, marking the Feast of the Epiphany on January 6th. The gondolas in the regatta, each with a rower dressed as a witch, race in the morning from San Tomà to the Rialto Bridge, with celebrations continuing throughout the day. As Diana knows, the far more exciting race involving dangerous magic takes place at midnight. Demons and witches are spread throughout the city, their lodgings dependent on their socioeconomic status. Demons tend to cluster around the Venetian Arsenal or in the textile and art centers of the city. Some of the witches, such as Laura Malipiero, run small pensioni that cater to human tourists and their fellow witches, who overrun them around times such as Carnival and the Regatta. The vampire elite, who have come out on top in the brutal power play of the city, own much grander lodgings. Matthew Claremont, Baldwin Montclair, Gilbert d'Orillac, and Domenico Michel, who was reborn there, have had palazzos in the city for centuries. Almost all those who are able to get into the real estate market early have palazzos on the Grand Canal, or just off it. These are very lavish, particularly Matthew's house, Cacchieromonte. Cacchieromonte Palazzo, Grand Canal.
Cacchieromonte was an appropriate dwelling for someone like Matthew, who had played a pivotal role in Venetian business and political life for centuries. Its three floors, Gothic facade, and sparkling windows screamed wealth and status.
Diana was too preoccupied to appreciate the full beauty of Matthew's Venetian residence on her first visit to the city. Its magnificent interiors, with lantern-like leaded bay windows overlooking the entrance to the Grand Canal, and rich red and gold decorations, illustrate the De Clermont's high standing in Venice. When the weather warms up, there is also the garden to sit in, with Matthew's pet turtles fighting a losing battle to keep the mosquitoes at bay. Cacchieromonte, or Chieromonte House, named after the Italian translation of Clermont, is based on the 15th century Palazzo Fallier. This was once the palace of Doge Marin Fallier, or Marino Falliero, a notorious figure who, after being elected Doge, plotted to take absolute power in the city. He paid the price for the coup's failure and was beheaded in 1355 by the ruling aristocrats and the Venetian Senate. Today, a black shroud still covers the space where his portrait should be, in Venice's Great Council Hall.
I was in Venice for the first time doing location research for the Book of Life and had an intrepid native Venetian lady, Bruna, as my guide. Somehow, she got us into Palazzo Falliere, which remains privately owned and is not usually open to the public. As I was walking through the Piano Nobile, the impressive main floor, I spied this wonderful carved fireplace with the motto of Francis I and Christopher Marlowe inscribed, "What nourishes me, destroys me." That was all the sign I needed that this should be the model for Matthew's house in Venice. At the time of writing, you can rent a flat in the Palazzo for your holiday and enter through the grand front door to reach it.
Isola della Strella, the Congregation Headquarters. The Congregation moved to Venice in 1453, following Constantinople's fall to the advancing Ottoman navy. Members brought books, precious objects, and records of creature history to the city, and purchased an island in the lagoon from the Catholic Church, Isola della Strella, Island of Stars. On it were monastic buildings that were converted to suit the congregation's purposes. The original character has remained in the place where they still meet today, the hushed cloisters and the well at the center that once supplied water to those staying there, large, high-ceilinged halls, the vast ancient monastery library, filled with books, papers, and papyri. The congregation's meeting chamber, Cella di Novem, an octagon-shaped room with a domed roof where the nine members of the Creature Council sit. This council chamber, with its stunning frescoes, mosaics, vaulted ceiling, and gallery where the most precious records are kept, embodies the congregation's power. The large oval table at its center is surrounded by high-backed chairs, each marked with specific symbols, the De Clermont Ouroboros among them. The island is protected by powerful magic to turn away prying human eyes, and witches bound powerful spirits to the island to serve as its security force. There are far fewer creatures on the island in the present time than there were in 1453, and only a handful of permanent staff run the place. Congregation members and their personal attendants are welcome there at any time as they conduct official business. Small rooms are available for them, really just converted monastic cells that were once necessary refuges for creatures during time of plague, war, and bad weather. Today, most members of the congregation prefer to reside in their Venetian palazzos or personal lodgings when they are called to town for formal council meetings or to do other business, shuttling back and forth between Venice and the remote island by Vaporetto. There was no single inspiration for the Isola della Strella. Instead, it was stitched together from the legends and history of two islands in the Venetian lagoon. One is Poveglia, with its octagonal fort and haunted past. It is now uninhabited, but once was used to quarantine plague victims. The other is the island of San Francesco del Deserto, which is still home to a handful of monks. Magic. The magic in the All Souls world spans the breadth of magical possibilities. Witches wield their power in two different ways, magic and witchcraft.